Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's an author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and most recently, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Great. I thought we'd do a focus today on inflation, the how, what, why, when of that. And we can also explore how this is causing wealth and income inequality and how it could widen that gap, potential for other issues like civil unrest, and other government issues. So maybe we begin with a discussion of the core dynamics of inflation, if you want to guide us through that.
Okay, I'll make a couple of points. And I think it's a great topic. Everyone's talking about inflation and anticipating it. And it's been the backdrop of the post-war economy for the last 75 years. In the general context that governments that suffered the consequences of hyperinflation in the pre-World War II era, like Germany, have been hyper sensitive about keeping inflation under control. And when inflation got away from the Federal Reserve in the late 70s, then it was extremely disruptive to the U.S. economy, and that required Fed Chair Volcker to like completely crush the expectations of inflation by jacking interest rates to 18%, and that of course caused a severe recession. So, you know, my point in all that kind of context is inflation is one of the most difficult to control forces, you know, once it's unleashed, and yet it has immense, you know, repercussions, you know, that it tends to completely disrupt economies in a way that nothing else quite can, short of war. So there's a deep concern about inflation and about the calls by the Federal Reserve and other people that they want to see higher inflation. And to your point about wealth inequality, you know, because wages have been stagnant the last 50 years for the bottom 90% of wage earners, then inflation has been making them poorer, right? And so they've been impoverishing people that depend on their wages. And those people who have capital and depend on the returns of capital have easily outpaced inflation and scored gigantic gains far beyond inflation. So to some degree, this idea of, oh, we need like modest inflation has actually been a driver for wealth inequality. And it continues to be because there's a huge asymmetry between classes in terms of inflation. And we could fill a whole show with just that, but I'll just touch on a couple points that it all depends on what you're exposed to. So a wealthy family spends a relatively modest amount of its money on essentials that are the kinds of things that tend to go up in price, right? So inflation really isn't going to impact them that much because their income's so high. It's going to have a outsized impact on people who spend most of their wages on things like rent and food and utilities and cell phone and so on. So that's one asymmetry that inflation may have almost no effect on the top 10%, but it can have a huge impact on people depending solely on their labor because their labor is not gone up, not matching inflation at all. Another little twist is even in the middle class, people who are exposed to like college tuition or healthcare, that if those expenses are not subsidized by the government or their employer, then they're exposed to just enormous inflation, right? that say college tuition has gone up like fivefold or tenfold, and same with healthcare costs. So it also depends on what kind of subsidies ways you have to evade exposure to the market price of things, like childcare and college tuition and healthcare. So all of that mixed in, what we've ended up with is an enormous wealth and income inequality, which has driven populism, which is also has an impact on inflation, which you and I were discussing before we started recording.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the driver of all of this is excessive government debt, and that is basically debt that has been accumulated over many years, and it's just gotten to the point where it's just so high. And given a lever between high debt and low interest rates, you know, of course, interest rates have gone lower and lower. They've been repressed artificially by central banks. That lever of the interest rate times the level of debt, given the serviceability of debt, has essentially gone to its maximum point, you know, on the high side for the level of debt and on the low side for the how low interest rates can go. So what are the choices? Like, you've got three choices to deal with this now. And one is you can default on the debt, or you can raise taxes, create new taxes, regulations of some sort. But that's generally unacceptable. Or you can do inflation. So they're certainly not likely to do a default, although that may also happen in the form of perpetual bonds, which is something that may happen with European debt. There's been some discussion on that. The way that works, the concept is all of the government debt is just converted into an annuity. So you never get back your principal. You essentially just get paid out on a yearly basis, whatever the yield is, which is, you know, generally small, 1%, 2%, 3% type of thing. So that may happen in that sense, you know, for a default. But the third choice in terms of inflation is very likely to be used, and it's been used in the past and historically. And so what's happening now is the Fed has got to the point, and central banks have got to the point where they have tried a lot of quantitative easing, a lot of money printing, repression of interest rates, especially during the first financial crisis, the first phase of the financial crisis, if we consider this the second phase that we're in now. And so we're at the point where they're more likely to do MMT, modern monetary theory, in the form of direct deposits into citizen bank accounts, universal basic income, financing infrastructure projects, like large-scale infrastructure-based projects on the environment, on energy systems. So very likely to see that. This is direct fiscal stimulus, essentially, with the government involved as well, into the economy. Very likely to cause inflation. I mean, of course, we have significant deflationary forces in the economy in the form of global labor arbitrage, robotics, process automation. But in the end, it's very likely that governments and central banks will push the inflation choice in order to reduce the burden of debt. That's what it's all about. Because when you do the math, you get, you know, 4% inflation over 10 years, let's say, it would reduce the burden of debt by half, something like that. If you do the math, that's what it comes out to. So that seems to be the direction that's happening. And so we're likely to see that happen. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, that's a great explanation, Richard. And I like how you listed the default and as one choice, higher taxes as the second, and inflation as third, when you have these enormous debts. and you still need to borrow more. And so my first thought, of course, was to let's look for examples in the real world. And so we know that countries like Argentina have always chosen default, right? And that gives you one advantage, which is it's a clean sweep, right? You know, your creditors are wiped out. They get nothing, or they get, you know, pennies on the dollar. And then you can start out fresh, right? You don't have to try to service that debt anymore. It's gone. The higher taxes and the inflation, I think Japan is an interesting kind of example because, you know, they've had a stagnating economy for like 30 plus years. And so they've attempted to dig their way out of that deflationary stagnation by massive infrastructure spending, right? Bridges to Nowhere and so on a massive scale, and it hasn't worked, right? Their economy is still stagnant. And of course, there's demographic issues there of an aging workforce and so on. And then when Japan has tried to increase taxes, a consumption tax, then it triggers a recession. And because they've, you know, the whole idea is that you're trying to keep your economy growing, right? And so while you deal with, you know, increasing debt, the idea behind the debt is to keep your economy growing, because if your economy is expanding, then you can always resolve virtually every problem, right, is the thinking. So if higher taxes trigger a recession, then you've actually dug yourself a deeper hole, right? So that's probably, as you say, not a wise choice. But when we go to inflation, we get all these other elements involved in what looks like a straightforward proposition. And one of them, of course, is your banking sector, because if you keep interest rates really low and you are unable to increase wage inflation, your banks can't find anybody to loan to. You know, they're forced out on the risk curve, and it's hard for them to make money. So, you know, the central banks have always got to keep their private banking sector solvent, and both Japan and Europe have struggled to do so with super low interest rates and a stagnation kind of stagnant economy. So it's I think that my point here is that inflation is like has multiple sort of second order effects, right? That if you let it get away from you, you actually increase the poverty of your bottom 90% wage earners, and you can also sink your banks, right? Because they've issued loans at low interest rates, and now inflation is eating away the value of their loan book. And so, you know, it's a Goldilocks problem, right? And central banks and governments want inflation to be high enough to like erode the debt service, but not so high that you trigger all these other unintended consequences. But I guess my concern is based on history. It's pretty hard to keep the Goldilocks inflation balanced. And I think if you cannot get in wages increasing, then any kind of inflation is going to end up creating social disorder, because people are actually earning less in terms of their purchasing power. And that's going to drive populism. And, you know, the two things we're seeing already is globalization and financialization are getting pushed back, right? Those were sort of the drivers of prosperity, but it turned out that they were super asymmetric, right? They were only benefiting the top 10% and the owners of capital. So as that populist pushback goes into gear, then you end up possibly creating more inflation, as you said before we started recording, because you're going to get potential for trade restrictions, protectionism, decline in global trade, which can be highly inflationary. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about those populist impacts.
Yeah, exactly. Let's look at what the drivers are and can be for inflation. So what we're seeing now is a number of things happening. First, of course, we've got supply chain disruptions happening as a result of the COVID response globally. So You know, whereas before there was supply chain coming in globally from different countries, food, consumer products, electronics. Now it is likely to be beset with several types and occurrences of supply side disruptions, the inability to get products shipped, products entering in terms of imports or exports, any issues involved there. And this could be exacerbated by protectionism, right, between within one country and between countries. So there would be restrictions perhaps on exporting certain items. So that would make it all the worse. But also from the perspective of, you know, if you can't get your cell phone part from China anymore, now you've got to make it locally somewhere in the U.S., the labor cost being higher. So, the price is going to be much higher for that. So that'll drive inflation also much higher. So we've got supply side, supply chain disruptions, protectionism. Then you look at the stimulus. So we have monetary stimulus and we have fiscal stimulus. Of course, with monetary stimulus, the money printing, quantitative easing type of programs, different types there. So that basically adds, more currency, more monetary stimulus to the overall financial system, fiscally as well, either by a combination of governments and or central banks, financing, printing money out of thin air, essentially, to finance infrastructure-based projects. We just talked about that a little bit, the whole idea of MMT, modern monetary theory. So that's all likely to contribute to inflation. And then, of course, you've got devaluation as another factor. So devaluation of the currency, depreciation of the entire purchasing power of the currency. This could be intentional, as it has been in many countries of the world in the last several decades, to facilitate exports, right? Because if you have a cheaper currency, it's easier, cheaper to export things because they're less expensive from whoever is importing. So that could be intentional by governments as another form of financial repression, devaluation, depreciation of currency. So you got these four factors that are driving inflation. Your thoughts, Charles?
Right. And I would add to that, Richard, I'd like to focus a little bit more on the classic economic theory would hold. If the Fed and the Treasury pump in like $2 trillion into the household accounts, right, either with direct money or infrastructure spending, much of which ends up as wages, that normally you'd anticipate the production of whatever was scarce, right, and rising in price, then you'd see somebody invest in increasing production so that the cost, supply and demand would stabilize or equalize, and you'd have moderate, if any, inflation, right, because production was going to rise along with a household income. But there's constraints on production that I think are poorly appreciated by the mainstream. So let's say that you've got shortages of childcare, which is definitely a case in many parts of the United States. Well, it's hard to start a childcare center. It's hard to get the right approvals. You have to have the vetting of the staff. You have to have the right location, which could be very expensive. And so it ends up almost being impossible to say, I'm going to create a childcare business that offers the same service at a much lower price than the existing. And it may be that's not a wise investment, because the return is really modest, the risks are high, and so on. So you're going to have enormous production supply limitations on both products and services. And to give you a product example, to take your cell phone part, it's not a trivial thing to make a semiconductor. In other words, somebody's expected to pony up hundreds of millions of dollars to make a new fab or something, fabrication plant. And it's all like, no, it's if the return is not there, if the risk is too high, if the supply chain is not there, then no one in their right mind would dump that kind of money in. And so you can have severe shortages because the production is simply not there, and there and never will be there because it doesn't make any financial sense, right? And so what you're going to see is you're going to see existing factories go to a third shift and that kind of thing to try to make up for it. But, you know, because our production is so highly centralized, there's limits on that too. You know, beyond the third, you know, shift, the factory's running full out. There's nothing anybody can do. And yet no one's, it's simply not financially feasible or profitable to go build another factory. You see, so I could see like shortages becoming severe, and that the more money that's poured into the economy, then the more demand is going to push prices way out of line. And this is where you could see stuff double, triple, quadruple in price. And no one's expecting that because for the last, say, 30 years, any production demand was met from overseas. In other words, via globalization that you spoke to. And if that's restricted or there's embargoes or you know, restrictions on trade from either the import or export side, then that's the safety valve is gone. And then you're going to see tremendous shortages and price increases for which there's no solution. And nobody's thought that through. And one other quick factor is demographics. As those of you who follow agriculture know, globally in the developed world, the average age of farmers in developed countries like, you know, Japan and the U.S. and Canada is in the late 60s, early 70s. And the same, it's also true in China. So there's this entire generation of skilled workers, not just in agriculture, but in production of ships and welding and a lot of high skills. Those, that whole generation is retiring, and there is not the replacement workforce. It does not exist. And so you're going to get production bottlenecks that no one anticipates because there's no one, not enough young people have these skills.
Mm-hmm. And if we go through some of the causes and effects of this, let's do that because I think it's important to understand in terms of what's happening in today's environment. So we talked earlier about excessive government debt driving the option, the decision to do inflation as most likely, and then inflation causing the wealth and income divide, exacerbating that between the wealthy and the poor middle class. The poor and middle class have very limited options if, you know, you have rising prices. So they get hurt the most, whereas the wealthy have means to handle those rising costs, as well as investments, easier to be able to protect themselves in that environment with certain types of investments. So again, this all exacerbates the wealth and in income inequality gap, which then leads to social implications. So I want to get into that a little bit more here, Charles. So what could happen, and it has happened historically, when that happens, there then begins a finger-pointing game, right, where the poor and middle class, maybe at the suggestion by governments, point fingers to the wealthy. You've then got the imposition of wealth taxes, or much higher taxes on the wealthy, which then causes potential for brain drain and wealth drain, which then causes loss of prosperity and a declining standard of living in the country. This has been seen in many countries and historically as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great point, Richard, because what happens, as we know from history, is the super wealthy, the sort of billionaire class, they have the political power to evade these wealth taxes, right? They'll start a foundation, or they'll shift their capital overseas, or, you know, there's a lot of tricks, right? And you can just buy political influence and get an exemption for your particular form of wealth, right? And so it ends up that these wealth taxes are typically end up hitting the most productive class. And this is, as you say, this is what creates the brain drain, or people just retiring and saying, there's no point in me working at full capacity because all I'm doing is just paying extra taxes. So I'm going to only work part time. You know, I'm going to cut my, you know, if the first $50,000 of income is, say, tax-free, which is another thing I anticipate, as a way of trying to get more money into the household budget, then the federal government could just say there's no tax on the first $50,000. Well, there'll be people that are, you know, making hundreds of thousands and paying huge taxes that'll just say, well, I'm just going to work and make the minimum, that 50 grand, and call it good. You know, I'm going to move to a low cost area, et cetera. So I guess the point I'm saying is, in theory, wealth taxes should do something. But in the real world, the wealthiest will buy political influence and evade that. And we could actually go back to the late Roman era. And this is exactly what happened, you know, that the super wealthy elites maintained their fortunes, which were 20 to 30,000 times larger than the average wealth of, you know, the Republican era of Rome. And it was the skilled labor and the entrepreneurs who ended up being driven into poverty by the higher taxes. So I think you're onto something. And it also is inflationary, because for those people that will have to pay the higher taxes, they're going to raise the cost of their goods and services, right? Because, you know, they're not going to just give up their wages or earnings. You know, they're going to try to compensate by raising prices. And so then you end up feeding the inflationary monster.
Yeah. So what's the answer to this? We usually like to end on a positive note with some positive ideas, how a good system, if you will, can look. Now, of course, the migration from what we have now to that may require some strategy, a migration strategy that takes quite some time. But in the end, I think some type of system first that doesn't get us to excessive government debt, right? That's the initial problem. So certainly limited debt, right? Limited debt overall, or manageable debt, I should say, and a limited government and a more efficient government. The idea of having a population that is globally competitive, very well educated, able to produce high demand products, high quality products through high levels of education, a global competitiveness, I think is very important. Decentralization, you've mentioned in many of your books. Can you expand on some of these ideas?
Yeah. Richard, if we look at even ancient economies and we say, well, what can we learn from them? But, you know, human nature is still, you know, we're 1.0, right? So there's actually lessons to be learned. And if we look at like the Tang Dynasty in China or like the Roman Empire in the West, their economies flourished for like long periods of time when costs were low. There was a stable currency. There were low barriers to entry for entrepreneurship and for trade, right? And so when those started going away, when the costs became prohibitive, when the currency started losing value, you know, started being inflated away, devalued, and when the barriers to entry were restricted to benefit the few, right, at the top who didn't want any competition, then these economies that were flourishing fell apart. And so when you talk about decentralization, what's interesting is, of course, decentralization is core to keeping competition, right, and barriers to entry low. And that it's centralization that creates monopolies. And then those are anti-competitive. Those are high cost structures. And so the problem here going forward is going to be the stable currency, because the central banks are trying to inflate away their currency, right? They're trying to devalue their currency or create inflation, which is another way of devaluing the purchasing power of the currency. And so this, I think, is the potential Achilles heel of all the conventional strategies. I think we're going to have to look beyond fiat currencies. And, you know, a lot of people are looking at gold-backed currencies or commodity-based currencies. I think cryptocurrencies. I think what I see is a need for a competitive market of currencies, not just a monopoly of a fiat currency, right, that we're all forced to use. Because if the government or central bank devalues that currency sufficiently, we all become poorer no matter how hard we work or how clever we are. So you've got to have a system that enables a stable currency environment. And I think competitive currencies is the solution that I would choose, which would be a spectrum of currencies to choose from. Now, of course, central governments hate this. They want complete monopoly over all money because they want to be able to devalue it at will, right? But I think that the wiser heads would favor an actually open market for currencies.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That would really provide the stability and that we need. But in terms of like the classic setup for widespread prosperity, it's always like low costs, which comes from low barriers of entry to producing and trading goods, a stable currency, and so when we talk about it, as you say, not being so reliant on debt, not relying on extreme centralization of financial and productive power. All of these things go to creating the environment for lower costs, right? Because a low barrier to entry, more people can jump in and produce goods and services. And a decentralized economy is full of competition. And so that's what brings costs down and encourages people to enter the market, not as getting free money from somebody, but as actually, you know, producing something. So I totally agree with you. And so we need to break up the monopolies and lower the barriers of entry. And there's going to be huge pushback from the monopolies that are benefiting. And so I think it will take a tremendous crisis politically and socially to get this done. But there is, I think, a roadmap.
Yeah. And of course, the barrier to entry being low, the whole idea of fostering an environment for innovation and entrepreneurialism, those would be two big initiatives and efforts to foster.
And yeah,
as you emphasize, the whole idea of a stable, strong currency would benefit the poor and the middle class very much, and make it less on the wealth and income inequality. So you've got a limited government, globally competitive population, educated, with manageable debt overall, in an innovation and entrepreneurial type of environment.
Yeah, absolutely right, Richard. And I think the problem is going to be all the insiders who are benefiting from the monopolies. And of course, government itself is a monopoly. And banks are monopolies, and, you know, on and on and on. So to break those up, it's going to be a real challenge, and there will be political attempts. But I want to bring up Peter Drucker, the sort of management guru from the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. In 1993, he wrote a book called Post-Capitalist Society, which he was discussing a knowledge economy, which is what you just mentioned. The key traits in a knowledge economy is a well-educated workforce and opportunities to use their innovation, right? And so one of his ideas was kind of like F. Buckminster Fuller, that we only, you know, advance if we obsolete the existing system. We're never going to get the insiders and the people that own the monopoly to let go. You know, yes. They're going to fight to the last bitter end to hold right. on to their power.
Yeah.
So we have to obsolete them. And Drucker was quite blunt. He said, even back in 93, he foresaw the end of higher education and the healthcare system as it was, that these things are just too inefficient, too bloated. they're not sustainable. And so they're going to be obsoleted by something. And we just have to accept that enormous industries will be obsoleted. And that's where it's extremely difficult for politicians to accept the fact that these enormous industries are actually no longer sustainable and no longer viable, and they have to go away. And the new system will be much more efficient. So we're starting to see how higher education is starting to break up. You know, with remote learning, it's like, why do we have to spend $55,000 a year on tuition? You know, and healthcare is also breaking apart at the seams for a lot of reasons. And so there's going to be a lot of pain for people that were clinging on to these obsolete models. And we're going to have to be willing to grit our teeth because those things are going to fall apart anyway. And the longer you cling on to them and the more money you pour into try to keeping it afloat, the greater the disruption you're going to cause. And I would say, frankly, we have to face that starting with the airline industry. It overexpanded. It expanded to a point where it required enormous growth globally in air travel every year. And if that is not going to happen, then that industry has to shrink, and there's going to be tens of thousands of fewer jobs, and that's just the way it is. And so I guess my point is, if we want a healthier, more sustainable economy, we're going to have to absorb the pain that comes from monopolies and cartels being broken up or obsoleted.
And there you go, the great insight by Charles, America's philosopher. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. You can download samples of all my books, including my most recent one, A Hacker's Teleology, and everything on the site's free.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.